Ms. Ostapenko has no challenges remaining.
Welcome to No Challenges Remaining. I'm Ben Rothenberg, joined by NCR's Spain and Sub-Saharan Africa correspondent Tumani Carryall. Tumani, hello. Good to have you back.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
We are here to discuss the Sunshine Double, the two big 1,000-level tournaments that take up the month of March. It used to be a more unique thing, but now we have lots of these sort of 10-day, two-week, 1,000 events dotting the calendar, but this still feels like a interesting standalone part of this of the calendar here, and we're going to do them together. So let's just get right into the results here and work our way out from there. We got a bunch of questions from listeners as well. We can answer along the way. But let's start with Indian Wells, which is the first of the two events, and the women, where Iga Świątek pretty handily won Indian Wells for the second time in her career after winning in 2022 for the first time. She doesn't drop a set en route to the title. Lots of bakery products along the way as well, finishing with a bagel in the final against Maria Sakkari. Tumani, what are your thoughts on this sort of seeming business as usual event for Świątek? And if you want, you can also look ahead to her Miami results as well, where she lost midway through. But what do you think of this whole March performance from the number one on the WTA side?
It's funny to think that last season it took her until the end of the year to get her first 1,000 title.
Mm.
But now she's obviously generally playing at an extremely high level away from the slams. Indian Wells was a dominant run. Soha Court obviously favours her, gives her more time to set up her ground strokes, and just no one could really live with her. In terms of ranking, obviously her toughest opponent was Sakkari. She didn't face any other top five player or anything, but it was just a dominant run. And it's funny, we should note that it's not normal to constantly win these matches by such dramatic margins, bagels everywhere, 6-1s, and it's not normal, but she's just continually showing that she's such a good front runner, and that when she's in good rhythm and playing well, it's so difficult to stop her. So that was a great performance in Indian Wells, and again reinforced just how consistently she's playing. And but obviously then came Miami. A tough was surprised, to be honest. Being perfectly honest, I did not watch the Alexandra match live. It was late at night. I had I had some other work in the morning. Went to sleep, and then you wake up, and a straight set 6-4, 6-2 loss was surprising. And I think it's a reflection of her dominance that a loss to the 14th seed is a shock. Again, we know the difference between Indian Wells and Miami. Indian Wells being slower conditions, Miami the courts are a bit faster. And I think Świątek is still, if she's ever vulnerable, it's in those conditions, and against a player who can just rush her. And we've been through this many times before. It's not a disaster. I think I'm sure she wanted to. She had visions of going further and possibly trying to replicate what she did in 2022 when she won the Sunshine Double, but I'd say a disappointed early loss, but it wasn't a disaster. And what do you think?
No, I think that's right. And I think the Sunshine Double, even though she did it once before, is still a very, very lofty goal. It's a very rare feat for a reason. At the time that she did pull it off, I think honestly was a kind of weird transitional time for women's tennis. Remember, that was the tournament when she got her second half of the Sunshine Double in 2022. That's when Barty announced her retirement during that 2022 Miami tournament. And I think Badosa was the number two player in the world at that point. It was just a very sort of, shifting sort of time. And there was maybe more space for her there. And Alexandrova, big hitter, having a good night and firing and beating maybe a slightly tired Świątek, who had gone deep three sets against Noshkova the round before. It's one of those things I didn't expect, but in retrospect, you can look at it and have it make sense. And in hindsight, seeing that result and processing it. And even just looking at her results and how good they were, it jumps out to me. Her first match in Indian Wells was a 6-3, 6-love win over Danielle Collins, who wound up winning the Miami tournament. So it shows how a week-to-week thing can change the fortunes of a player considerably there. I think she's in good shape. I think she shapes up well for the clay court season. We're going to talk about Sabalenka maybe a bit later, but Sabalenka did not have a good Sunshine Double on court, and after having such an and has not really played great since Australia. We'll get into some of the personal stuff with her later when we talk about her, but I think what I bring her up right now just to say, I think Świątek has space from the pack, and I think that she has a pretty comfortable margin, looking at her against the field, heading onto her preferred clay, heading into Paris, obviously, ultimately on the clay. And even Paris Olympics, you want to throw that in there as well. It's the second big clay court tournament of this summer coming up. I think that Iga has to like where she's at vis-a-vis the field. Lots can change, obviously, but I would currently take her against the field at any tournament she enters on clay.
No doubt about that. I mean, if last year things weren't ideal for Świątek going into the clay court season, and they weren't ideal during it, the clay court season, when she got injured. You know, she didn't win a title until Roland Garros. She got injured in Rome, and yet it still ended with her winning Roland Garros, her third in 4 years. So yeah, it's certainly on clay. It's still in my head, Iga versus the field, and at the moment, I'm taking Iga.
We got a question from one of our listeners about Iga, Joy Katz, who asked, she said, I feel like there's a dearth of granular insight into Iga's game compared with other, especially men's players. It goes by so fast. Can you help me be in awe of it? And I think that, you know, for me, yeah, Iga, when she's firing, like you said, she just has this way of looking like she's playing, I think people say in sports, like downhill, right? She just sort of like has momentum and is just a rolling stone that keeps going, gathers momentum and just runs people over. And once she gets that lead, you see that the weapons at work, the quick strikes that are also still heavy, especially that forehand. Yeah. Watching her cross-court forehand, especially that sweeping shot that pulls the opponent so far out to their right side of the court, usually their forehand if it's a righty side, that's such a killer shot. We saw her hit winners from that in all sorts of ways, including against men in United Cup and mixed doubles. Like, that's just such a game-breaking shot and such a powerful shot. That's, to me, the shot I would show trying to explain Iga. And then the speed too. I mean, like, I watched like Peyton Stearns a bunch during this month, or a couple times anyway, and she has a similar kind of at times heavy ball, but she doesn't have kind of Stosur-esque heavy ball, and that's what Iga has too. But Iga also has the movement, and it's that combination of speed, athleticism, plus the heavy strokes that are really unusual in women's tennis. In women's tennis, you've either been a big power hitter or a speedster. And I think, with the exception maybe like the Williamses, but they didn't hit the ball as heavy per se. They were flatter hitters than Iga. So I think she's a really unique athlete in that sense. And yeah, I think that for me, those sorts of gifts of hers are very apparent.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to echo what you say, but her forehand, as you said, it's a kind of ATP style forehand. It's, you know, with a lot of wrist work and just generates so much topspin and allows her to hit, you know, more angles than other players as well as the fact that she has such a fast arm. So it's just the ball's moving so fast with such heavy topspin, and it's just hard to deal with. And again, as you said, she's out hitting you. She's a bigger hitter than almost anyone in terms of, again, weight of shot, as well as raw power, and she's also faster than the players, and she can also get to so many more balls. She can be in position for so many more balls. I'd also say, like, you look at Djokovic versus other players, and even at the very top of the game, players normally have a weaker wing, you know, a wing that you you're playing towards, and Djokovic does, you know, he's the player whenever, you know, at his best, he's the player targeting the opponent's wing, whereas the opponent's like, where the hell do I hit the ball, right? And the thing that's with Iga, it's funny, you know, you look at her game, and again, we've talked about her forehand, it's so devastating, and, you know, it can just hit people off the court, but I still think her backhand's the best shot. It's the shot that's more consistent, it's the shot that just almost never lets her down, and it's also really destructive as well. So it's so much, and I think she has that, but again, the ball striking ability and the athleticism, and I think it's such a great base also to build on, you know, as she goes older. We've seen her, you know, trying to come to the net, and I actually feel like she's lost some of her variety, the variety she had, say, a couple of years ago when she may have hit more drop shots or something. But we have seen her trying to come to the net. I think we should also mention her returning as well, which is just unbelievable at times. And I loved watching her in United Cup, just like breaking the souls of the male players who serves she returned. And I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, but I asked her about that at the Australian Open, and like just if she enjoyed the challenge, and she was just of returning male players' serves, and she was like beaming, and she was like, "I loved it, I loved it, and I loved seeing them." You know, it hurt them, and so yeah, she's an unbelievable returner as well. And when all of that just comes together, there's just nothing that most of these players can do, most of her opponents can do. Really, being honest, and that's why we see these scorelines, you know, when she's in her groove, that it's just so, as you say, so quick and so dominant.
Yeah, definitely. No, she is. And the one thing she doesn't really have hugely is a great, you know, serve, first, second serve. Doesn't get a ton of free points on that, considering how A-plus so much of the rest of her game is. That is not, it's not horrible, but it's not up to the standard of the rest of her game. And that's the one thing I think is probably most attackable for her. You see other players who are really aggressive returners, like, you know, Danielle Collins, let's say, sometimes when they played each other. Not obviously this time, but, you know, that Australian Open match she lost to her a couple years ago, where, or even the one that she was losing to her before turning it around this year, in that second round. Players can tee off on the second serve. And Ostapenko certainly did that to her at the US Open last year as well. Like, certain players who have that big first strike tennis can find something to feast on sometimes with the serve. That's the one weakness I would point to for sure. But yeah, the rest of it is very dynamic and very, just sort of like just immediately, I think, puts players on the back foot in this way, in a different way, with that, like you said, ATP style, with that topspin style that we haven't seen too much of. So yeah, and just again, the mental skill to be a front runner, as you said, I think to once she gets ahead, to keep staying ahead and to demoralize the opponent and have these really lopsided matches. That's pretty unique among the top players.
And I think just the other thing is just off the court, she's obviously she's just willing to do everything in service of being a great tennis player. And she puts in the work, both in terms of just the on-court work and also, as we know and as has been discussed many times, the mental work and the fact that that's been a priority. You know, there are a lot of players who get on the tour, you know, have a good period and then have difficulties and then are like, oh, maybe I should consult a sports psychologist or whatever. But that's been a priority of hers since she emerged on the tour. Yeah, I mean, I think I could go on forever talking about just her game and how good it is. It's not just that she's a great athlete. I think she's probably one of the top three, four athletes on the tour.
Yeah, pure athleticism, yeah.
So that's another advantage. And you mentioned the serve. I think that's a big question mark around her game, just how much that can improve if she will be able to have a Sinner-like or even a Djokovic-like improvement in that shot. She's clearly worked hard on it in the off-season. She changed her service motion this year. She's tried to simplify it and make it more smooth. The pace is up on it, and I actually think her second serve has improved as well. But it's in the moments when, you know, when she's not confident, that's when suddenly she's missing first serves or the second serve get shorter. And so, yeah, we'll see if that can improve to the point where it can get her out of situations. Because I think, you know, we talk about, like I mentioned, the disappointing loss in Miami. But I feel like it's in those types of matches when things aren't going well, when you could really do with, you know, the serve getting you out of trouble when other things aren't working. And that's just not what she can't yet rely on. That when she's playing well, she can, but when she's not, that's the first thing that normally goes in her game.
Yeah, definitely. So Świątek won this title in the final against Maria Sakkari, who had a great week, a resurgent week. She won her first match coming back from a set down against Diana Schneider, then beat Caroline Garcia, who has had a pretty solid start to the year, then beat Diane Perry, who has had a good start to the year as well, then beat one of the surprise players of the year, or breakout players of the year, Emma Navarro, and then Coco Gauff. Coco Gauff, sidebar on Coco before I get to Sakkari more fully. Coco, I don't know if it's the Brad Gilbert thing or what, but she is doing so much winning ugly lately, in where she doesn't seem to be playing tennis that looks like it's where things are working for her, but yet still getting deep in tournaments and still prevailing so often. It's both encouraging that she's able to win so much and also discouraging that it's rarely pretty. I'm curious what you think of Coco before I get to Maria more fully.
Yeah, it's funny because the very first tournament after she hired Brett Gilbert was in my opinion, some of the best tennis she's ever played. When she won
Washington.
Yeah, and it was just clean. You know, she was attacking and hitting her forehand really well. I do think it's just, I don't know, she's dealing with, even though it's the trajectory is very different to players who are coming from having, you know, no attention to suddenly winning a Grand Slam. I do think she's still maybe kind of dealing with that, which is normal, which every player mm-hmm. does. She's still not, played her best tennis this year or anything close to it.
She was again, just on a Vogue cover for the first time. I mean, she's having big moments,
Yeah, because again, like, the quality was good during periods in, well, for much of the summer, the hardcourt swing, ironically, aside from, you know, towards the end, well, during a lot of the US Open. But I do think Coco's also, that's kind of what she does really well, winning ugly, grinding out wins, using her defense and, you know, her problem solving and, yeah, just ability to dig out matches and her mental strength. But yeah, I think that's, it's clear, and I'm sure she's the first person who wants to find a way to dig out her best tennis more frequently. And I mean, we'll see just how that develops over this year, really. But I do think that some of it is down, some of it, not all of it, but some of it is down to maybe just, you know, her just trying to take this next step after winning a slam and figuring that out, which everyone goes through, really.
Yeah, for sure. It's just coming at, looking at her after coming off talking about Świątek, and even what Sabalenka did in Australia, let's say, where they're able to string together so many clean matches. That's kind of never really been Coco's thing at big tournaments, is, you know, putting together strings of wins where she looks comprehensively untouchable.
Yeah.
She's just so often kind of scraps. And again, she's winning a lot, so it's tough to argue with it, but so many of the wins this year have been winning ugly. Even the match she lost against Sakkari in the semis was her really, she did well to bring it to a third set in that match because she was getting outplayed and scrapped and fought. But Sakkari makes it to the final. Maria Sakkari, first tournament, first big tournament this was for her with David Witt as her coach. David Witt, who had previously coached Jess Pegula for a long time, but had been named the WTA Coach of the Year once while working with Pegula. Very successful partnership for him after previously having been the longtime coach of Venus Williams. We got a question about this Sakkari-Witt partnership, just basically saying, from Stephen Tiding's thoughts on the early returns with the Maria Sakkari-David Witt pairing. And, you know, Indy Wells final, that's, you know, equals the biggest final of her career. I think it's good. I think nothing to say. It's interesting with her because she and her coach Tom Hill spoke openly and uniquely about wanting to be together for the rest of their careers. They both said that. And not surprising that didn't last. I mean, few coaching pairings actually last that long. But she seems to have, yeah, found a good voice for herself. Witt is very low key and very chill, and kind of is an interesting counter to Sakkari's, let's say, more self doubt or neuroses on court that she's very open about having. I think that, yeah, it could be an interesting, very different energies. And whether that makes for a good match or becomes discordant, TBD, we'll see on how that opposites attract works. But for early returns, good.
Yeah, Sakkari's career, it felt like, I mean, it just felt like it was stagnating and she was struggling a lot. And I think it was just a mature that, despite how well her and Tom Hill got along and how, you know, great their rapport was, that she reached a point where she understood that she needed to try something different and she needed a new voice. They tried with, you know, with him and another coach. They tried everything, and I think this was a good decision. I think David Witt's, his, you know, what he's done in the past is kind of undeniable. In particular, you know, he was with Venus before, and then particularly with how he helped Pegula rise up the rankings and go from being, you know, on the ITF tour basically to being a top three player. Yeah, that I think so far so good. I think it, funnily enough, both of, also the partnership with Pegula just underlines how, you know, sometimes you need a change. I think he was quite surprised when Pegula decided to split with him because, you know, mm-hmm. he thought things were going well, etc. But it turns out that I think also Pegula needed a change and something different. It was interesting seeing her, I think it was in press, she talked about how she'd been struggling, you know, in past 3 months, and even after her result in Miami, that she was satisfied with how well she'd done and how happy she was on court and how happy she was off the court as well after difficult period. So, yeah, it seems like everyone of the two camps have ended up in the right place, which is always nice to see.
I trust Pegula to assess that herself, because her results have not been amazing this year by any stretch, you know, since this breakup. But if she's feeling better on court and feeling happier with whatever kind of, you know, vibes or behind the scenes stuff or just energy that she's feeling is an improvement for her, that's good for her. I trust her at this level of her career, and just being a very sort of generally being a self-aware player who I trust to be in charge of herself and being an adult in the room at times. I think that she's, yeah, very much someone to trust on that. It's interesting with Sakari, yeah, because she's been, you know, in this time, we talked in the last time on the show, and I still agree with it, about how the bottom part of the top 10 of the WTA is not impressive, not especially formidable right now. Sakari is part of that, but also she's reliably hung in there. You know, I think that she's kind of still a bit of an overachiever in a certain way. She's kind of got some WTA David Ferrer energies, I think, in certain set. Like, people don't think that she's the most talented, but she's not, and she's not undersized per se, but she's got this real grit and fight to sort of keep herself treading water at the very least, or keep herself above water in these very stormy seas of the top 10. And where other times other people are sinking or dropping, she seems steady, and that's impressive what she's doing. I do not at all discount her ability to hang around in the top 10 for this long during this era of real turbulence and transition and instability in women's tennis. So good for Maria there. I want to switch to the men in Indian Wells before we get to Miami. The men's side of Indian Wells was won by Carlos Alcaraz for the second year in a row. He defends his title there. He meets Medvedev in the final. The big win for him was in the semifinals, where he comes down back from losing the first set 6-1 to beat Jannik Sinner 6-3, 6-2 in the second and third sets to win that. That was Sinner's first and only loss of the year so far. Alcaraz had also handily beaten Zverev in the quarterfinals, which Zverev had beaten him in the Australian Open quarterfinals earlier this year. Alcaraz did not have a good run, especially, well, got hurt too, but did not have an impressive run really in the Golden Swing when he played in South America. He had that bad loss to Zverev in Australia. Really lopsided loss at a lot of points of that match. He comes back and loses in Miami. But I'm curious what you make of this this result for Carlos and him sort of at least keeping a foothold, I think, in the conversation, which was slipping away from him this year.
Yeah. I think he really needed a result like that. It's been very difficult for him, you know, funnily enough, since he won Wimbledon, really. Since then, it's just been tough. He hadn't won a title until Indian Wells. You saw, obviously, one of the reasons why he's won so much and also captured, you know, so much attention is because of how just instinctive his game is and just how it just feels like total tennis it is, in terms of him, you know, the athleticism, the shot making, the skill, and how at times it just feels almost like random, like there's no structure to it. But that's also why it's been, I think, difficult for him also, because there's no structure to it, and at times he's just at times hit himself off the court, you know, played some, you know, really bad, just poor matches, tons of errors. That, you know, think of that Australian Open, sorry, US Open quarterfinal against, sorry, that was Australian Open quarterfinal against Rev this year. It was pretty dire. And yeah, he was just off. And similar, I mean, I think he also got outplayed by Medvedev at the US Open, but it wasn't impressive. But yeah, he came in here, Indian Wells, and a court he really likes, and he found his best tennis again. It's also like, he's also had the adversity of the injury in Rio. He said when he first trained in Indian Wells, he trained for like 30 minutes and it wasn't great. Things were not looking good, but he gradually got back to full health, and yeah, as you mentioned, it was also good for him to get revenge on three opponents who had beaten him in big matches over the past year. So yeah, I'm still, as I've said in previous podcasts, I'm still not really worried about him. It's quite normal that players, particularly at the early in their career, they have some really talented players, they have highs, and then they have periods where they need to figure things out. And I think he's in that this period where he needs to figure things out. And again, I think as we're going to compare to Sinner, who does have a lot of it, but find more structure in his game, figure out how to win, you know, more, I don't know, just I mean, also when he's not playing well and, you know, winning ugly and all of that stuff, but also have more structure in his game and more just consistency and more margin and more of the boring things that, I mean, as a spectator, you don't want to see. You want to see random, you know, winners from from the crowd, you know, on the run. But yeah, I feel like that will come with age and maturity. And again, this was a good win to just give him some confidence and ahead of the clay season where I think he will be dangerous.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, Alcaraz has always had the fireworks in his game. It's just a question of getting the more stable sort of slow burn tactics. And it's also interesting with him, talk about how complete or incomplete he is as a player. He's in this era where coaching is legal, and it really does seem like he is the player who most, as far as we can observe, who seems most directed by his coach during matches, by his coaches during matches. And in that match against Sinner, where he lost first set 6-1, he really changed tactics, and I can only presume it was from some advice from his corner, hitting a lot more sort of looping high balls to Sinner getting more comfortable from that. Sinner had like a bad fall at some point in that third set. Like, it wasn't clear if he was 100% physically or sort of checked into that match at all times, but Alcaraz definitely did things to change it, the momentum of that match, dramatically. And that's been one of the knocks on him. It's just playing tactically unobservant tennis, let's say. Just kind of not always playing with a lot of brain, playing more with instinct, and that can only get you so far at certain times at this level. Against the players and against the coaches who you're playing against too, you know, when you have to kind of outthink Sinner plus Darren Cahill and his whoever other coaches are in the corner, you know, you have to be on top of that part of the game as well. And that's been slower for Sinner, that's been slower for Alcaraz, but he has shown that he can do it, and getting this title on the board, I think, is a good way to get some good momentum going into the clay swing, which is a very comfortable time of year for him in Europe. He feels like that Madrid term especially has been really a home term for him. He's won twice already in his career. I think he'll continue to gain momentum and stuff there, even if he lost, you know, quarterfinal of Miami to Dimitrov. I don't think that's a real important loss, similar to Świątek and her loss to Alexandrova. I think it's similar, kind of like, you're doing fine. You know, you win one and get halfway through the next term of the Sunshine Double, I think you're doing just fine. On Alcaraz versus Sinner, we'll discuss a bit later, but just on Sinner versus Alcaraz, we got a question from Michael Furman, who says, just love to hear us talk about Sinner-Alcaraz trajectory this year. Alcaraz looked to be taking back over, but nope. Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's going to be back and forth. I think Sinner is in pole position. I think he's got a good lead, but I think Alcaraz and Djokovic and Medvedev behind them are, you know, very much in this race. It feels like a kind of four-horse race, maybe Zverev distant fifth in this race. But yeah, it feels like there could still be some push-pull. Interesting about clay, which we think is a better surface for Alcaraz than Sinner, but Sinner's not bad on clay.
No.
We'll see how it goes. But I don't think it's over. I think Alcaraz absolutely can contend at each of the three remaining Grand Slams this year. You nodded. Yeah,
good. I agree.
I'm just making it audio for people who didn't see you nod on this audio format, yes.
But yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about Sinner in general, but I agree, Alcaraz is right there behind him. And I mean, it's also going to be a challenge for Sinner, who's, I mean, I think he's the best player in the world right now, and that's what the race says. He's lost just one match. I think he's 25-1 since Davis Cup, which is damn impressive. But it's also going to be a challenge for him to just sustain this through a whole season. I'm confident he can. That's the challenge for him, as well as for Alcaraz, catching up with him. And yeah, I think also the clay will be good for I think clay is actually helpful for Alcaraz in building points and, you know, going a bit further behind the baseline, being more patient. So yeah, I think it's fun. It's fun. It's fun to see both of them rising up, winning slams, winning big matches, playing great tennis. We've been waiting a long time for young players to step up and really play like they believe they should be winning slams, right? And play the big moments like that. And so it's just fun to see. And a lot of players have been hyped. A lot of potential rivalries have been hyped. But I think this is exciting. It felt like a moment when they played in in Indian Wells. It wasn't the best match, but I feel like it's going to be an occasion. But it's still a very thrilling match. I think it's going to be an occasion every time they meet, which is great. And we'll see who ends up on top by the end of the year.
It might have been their worst match, which kind of is a testament to how good their matches have been in the past, that Indian Wells match. So, yeah. Also, Michael mentioned in his question, wanted to hear AJ Eccles talk about this, and he will be back on the show, I think, to talk about the Challengers movie soon enough. So get excited for that, whatever that entails.
There was a new trailer today, I shouldn't know, and God, the serving, it made me wince. Zendaya, they showed her serving and her ball toss with her left hand. Her arm like covered her eye. How are you gonna hit your serve without seeing the ball? But anyway,
Cannon-esque. Consultant Sophia Cannon, Miami doubles champion. The last player I want to mention on the men's side of Indian Wells is Novak Djokovic, who lost early there. He's still number one player in the world. We've not mentioned him much in the show yet, but he's still number one. He went three sets in his opening match against Vukic, the young Australian, and then lost in the second round, or his second match, third round, after he had a bye, to Luca Nardi, who is a lucky loser, ranked, I think, 123rd during that week on tour, kind of climbing up the rankings, but undoubtedly a bad loss for Novak Djokovic to lose to Nardi. And then he pulls out of Miami. And so his sort of long-awaited return to this part of the calendar, not having been able to play here for a couple years because of vaccine restrictions, winds up being two matches and done. Does not seem encouraging for him. He also had an interview he did recently, or a press conference he did recently in Serbia, translated on Tennis Majors by Serbian tennis journalist Sasha Osmo, where he was quoted as saying, quote, "I still don't have a clear idea who a new coach would be." As by the way, oh, he also split with Goran Ivanišević, which you mentioned in this Djokovic segment. He says, "I still don't have a clear idea who a new coach would be, or whether there will be one at all. I've had coaches since I was a kid. Now I'm trying to feel by myself what I need, what I feel most comfortable with." I said that sounded kind of adrift. Sasha said it didn't sound as adrift, spoken out loud. But Djokovic feels like he's at a crossroads at this point in this year, where he's seeming, again, reading into his year so far, he seems like he feels, yeah, not on secure footing, unsure what to do. And having not won a title when he's so used to starting every year with an Australian Open title, you know, going into Monte Carlo titleless so far this year with no titles since, what, the US Open? Probably, or Bercy? Did we win Bercy?
Anyone? ATP finals.
That too. Yes, he won ATP finals, right, in Turin. That was his most recent title. But this year has not been great for him. He's not in the top 10, I don't think, in the race. No. He's not playing great in 2024. And just, you know, we talked about this after he lost in Australia. Like, would age catch up to him suddenly? And he alluded to that after his loss in Melbourne as well. Like, maybe this is the beginning of the end. I mean, who knows? We'll see what this boards, but this was not a confidence-inspiring month for Novak Djokovic, I would say.
Yeah, so I think the Australian Open semi-final was very weird, and just this level, it was just poor. It was unlike him, and on his favourite court, his favourite slam, it was iffy. But I do, in a way, think he's, I'm sure I've said this before, but I think he's in his Serena era as well. I think we'll see we'll see him at the end of May in Roland Garros when the slams are on the line. We'll see how, you know, where he is with his game, how mentally ready he is. Because I just don't think these matter to him that much anymore. Master, he's got so many of them. And yeah, I was very amused, actually. I was very amused by the whole tour movement going from Indian Wells to Miami, and he went with them, just chilled on the beach, did a few sponsor things.
Yeah,
and then
he clearly
went
had
back
some
home.
Sponsor stuff lined up in Miami.
Yeah.
But it was funny seeing him kind of like, I think people kind of thought, I don't think he ever said this, but kind of like, oh, he's going to pull out early and go home to spend time with his family. Like, no, he was spending time chilling out in Miami. just going to
NBA games, hugging Jokic and LeBron and Steph Curry.
Yeah, Steph Curry and all the guys. So, I mean,
but yeah, I do think it is alarming just the results so far this year. But at the same time, I think we should also be conscious of the fact that he won three slams and the ATP finals and, you know, last year. And just any time he needed to be there, when he really needed to be there, with the exception of the Wimbledon final, he was there. And so, definitely there's the question marks around him, and I'm sure he'll have questions about himself, but I don't know, just with his history, I'm we'll see. That's where I'm at. We'll see. I'm still expecting to see him, you know, to see other big wins soon.
Let me put you on the spot here briefly. Do you think Novak Djokovic wins a slam this year?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Confidently, yes.
100%. Okay. Well, not 100%, but like I'm confident that it may be one, but I'm confident that we'll see him bounce back at some point.
The interesting thing is that all these guys, I think, can contend, with the exception of probably Medvedev on clay. I think all of the top four guys can contend at all the slams, and Djokovic is very much a part of that. You know, he'll be in the mix. He can have moments, but yeah, just some flat efforts. That match against Nardi was an unusual loss for him, for sure. And when there was no real sign of trouble, I understand kind of maybe, and this is maybe part of, you said, Serena era, when sort of your back's up against the wall. And you look around and you're like, wait, this is Indian Wells third round. I don't need this bad. Yeah. That's what you're saying. Like, that's a change for him, because he hasn't really been that way most of the time before in his career. But there, obviously he has had some odd losses before at points, you know, and certainly losses to like Yuri Vesely not long ago when he was coming back from his deportation in Dubai or whatever. Like, there's been some, you know, some iffy losses, but this was one I didn't see coming at all. One of the more surprising losses for Djokovic, when it seemed like he'd be kind of rolling along, and then he just got bounced by Nardi in this tournament. Let's go to Miami, where Djokovic went just to not play. We weren't playing there either. The women's side, back to them. Danielle Collins is the winner for the women in Miami, and it seemed like a hugely popular winner. And I think this is it's sort of coming off Oscar season. I think it's a really nice, like, lifetime achievement award for Danielle Collins in a lot of ways, honestly, even though she's had a relatively short career. It's only really been a full-time presence on tour since 2018, which made her breakout run actually in Miami, making it to the semifinals of that tournament. In the last year, it was held at Crandon Park. Collins wins the title. She, after losing her first set in the first round to Bernarda Parra, she didn't lose a set the rest of the way, 14 sets in a row, finishing with a win over Elena Rybakina in the final. Collins, as a local Floridian, yeah, she has that thing in her career where she's had moments where she clicks in and things are firing. It's happened many different times sporadically throughout her career. She knows how to get hot, and when she gets hot, she can look unplayable, and this was her in that mode largely. And there, actually, the final 7-5, 6-3, that second set, I think, was closer than the score makes it look. That was really a battle for her, and she had to kind of fight and scrap to get over the finish line. Rybakina battled well there. But Collins is the winner. And I think, yeah, like I sort of said with the Oscars thing a minute ago, for me, it's just sort of a nice thing that Danielle got this moment, you know, to kind of get her flowers. When we know it, when she said it's going to be her final year on tour, she announced that after her loss in Australia. Yeah, for her to get this moment, does it translate into her contending at a slam later this year? I mean, who knows? Again, because she's so hot and cold, I could see her doing this again at the US Open or maybe even Wimbledon. You know, she's not awful on grass, not a ton of experience on grass, but not terrible on it. Yeah, I could see her having another moment, but I'm glad she got this moment in her final lap.
Yeah, it's nice that she has almost like a signature performance, I mean, like an actress.
Yeah,
but yeah, that will always remember her winning Miami. And it's just funny how things are. Obviously last year wasn't a great year for her. She had health issues, just also wasn't just playing great. And then she starts this year, you know, reveals very casually, actually. I think she told Blair Henley, was it, who, this was going to be her last year on tour. No big song and dance, no, you know, long...
It was in a press conference in Australia. I thought that she lost to Swiatek in Australia was the first time she said it.
Okay. But no, like, long, you know, Instagram post. But it seems like it's really freed her to play quality tennis. She obviously played great in Australia. Should have beaten, you know, was up 4-0 in the third set on Swiatek before losing 6 games in a row. But she's continued to play at a high level, and here, I don't know, it's funny how just tennis is so funny. Loses the first set against Bernarda Parra in the first round, but then just blitzes. I mean, until the final, she didn't concede more than 5 games against any opponent after that first set. And then obviously had to deal with a tough Rybakina, but I think she was always, in the final, she was clearly off the ground. She was just overpowering Rybakina, obviously a better mover. She was winning, you know, when the rallies were neutral, she was on top. And so, yeah, great win. I think it was a very popular among the Americans it was popular, among friends I think it was popular, and yeah, good for her. I don't think, yeah, she's been a top 10 player, she's a quality player. I don't think anyone can have any qualms about her winning Miami.
No, like I said, I think it's a feel good, honestly, not dissimilar to last year's title, which was by Petra Kvitova, who's sort of a veteran of the tour and got this not really anticipated title in Miami, but everyone's kind of happy for her. Obviously, Kvitova's had a lot more in her trophy case over the years. Collins had not won a title bigger than a 250, I don't think, before. But she's obviously had these moments, you know, deep runs and slams. We've seen how peak, in kind of a peak Pierce kind of way, peak Collins has been a real thing. Again, I mentioned before in this tournament, this episode that went over Swiatek in Australia, which was the last sort of rough loss for Swiatek before her dominant 2022 got started. Collins has that, and I've seen her just do it several times on courts big and small. I remember a couple times in Brisbane, I think it was in 2020, where she just was absolutely demolishing people. Svitolina, on those side courts, it just like really can just not tree, because it does it often enough, just zone and just blast people off the court at will. And it's really emphatic. You mentioned being a popular title. It's nice to see some Instagram shout outs from Serena Williams and Danielle Collins. Collins is interesting because I think she's can be very polarizing to fans. People see her being vocal and maybe a bit stroppy or strident in terms of her expressiveness and being a bit imperious on court, let's say, whatever you want to call it. But also behind the scenes, I think she's known for being just a nice, you know, down to earth person. And yeah, the Americans were sort of lining up to congratulate her, including Serena and Sloane Stephens and whoever else was there.
Yeah. I think she's also just real. Like, she knows who she is.
Yeah.
And everyone else knows where they stand with her. So there's never any doubt, you know. So yeah, I think, yeah, it was a popular amongst Americans. And
she also is grounded in this way, and this goes a bit to her retirement, but she has this sort of like good perspective on the tour and on tennis as a business and as a job. I think in a lot of ways it seems healthy, her balance that she has on these things. And I remember when Ash Barty retired and Collins was this is in the article I wrote about Barty that was cut from my book, but you can still buy the book, by the way. Ben Rothenberg wrote, not, I don't say my name first, but you know my name, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice by Ben Rothenberg, myself. But there was a section originally on Collins, how Collins, when Barty retired and everyone's like, oh my God, burnout, this is terrible. Collins was like, I think it's cool that this woman was able to make so much money in sports that she can be set for life. And that's, we'd be applauding that in any other industry. So why not in tennis, that, you know, this 25-year-old can retire happily. You know, and that's kind of, she's obviously didn't make quite Barty money, but, and she's a little bit older, but, you know, she's had health issues. She wants to have kids. I understood her getting frustrated with people every time she went around at some point being like, are you sure you want to retire, Danielle? You're playing so well. And that to her, she read that as sexist, which I thought was interesting. And I understand her thinking that because just people not taking her seriously, I think is where that comes from for her. Just thinking that she's flighty and susceptible to changing her mind is where she reads sort of gendered language into it, even if it wasn't apparently that way. It wouldn't have been my read on it, but I get it from where she's coming from on that. And you want to say something on that part? But I just think that she's very grounded and clear-eyed and an adult in this business.
To be fair, after she said that, someone asked her again, and she did say that she thinks it's coming from, you know, a nice place.
Yeah.
Just the question, and that they, you know, it was not a negative. So I think she probably realized that it was.
It could be tone, but also with that question, yeah, too. I mean, like, the tone can matter in that question.
Yeah. But still, I will not be asking her that question the rest of the year.
No. No, and it's good. It's fine to ask questions that allude to it. Like, what does this mean to you, knowing it's your last year on tour? But the kind of constantly, like, are you sure thing? And it's this interesting opposite end of the spectrum from Andy Murray, who's kind of getting told, like, he's getting asked, like, are you sure you want to keep doing this? It looks terrible. It looks really not fun. Like, let these adults, especially these particular adults, who I think are adults very much, both of them, have kind of, you know, they're not making these decisions rashly. Danielle did not decide all of a sudden she wants to do it, and it wasn't a flight of fancy thing for her, even if when she first did it that first day, Sloane got asked about it in press, and it was like, is she sure? She might just be sad she lost. I'm going to go check with her on that. But yeah.
I think we should just know that it's just a great achievement as well, considering, I mean, the reason she's retiring is because she has rheumatoid arthritis, because she has endometriosis, and both of those are just very difficult to deal with. you know,
and I'm sure explain a lot of the patchiness in her results, you know.
Yeah,
those are the factors that we don't always see that can flare up, that can have made it so that she's not consistently playing her best tennis all the time. I'm sure they're a very real factor for that.
Yeah, and she also mentioned that the effects get getting pregnant, and that's something that she's, you know, that's on her mind. So yeah, kudos to her for just being able to play at such a high level with it. And it's not obviously it's sad for them, but it's nice to see, you know, not just her, but Wozniacki, Venus, you know, players with autoimmune diseases still performing at the highest level.
Speaking of pregnancy, a couple grass court specialist pregnancies on the ticker recently, Sabine Lisicki and Alison Risk. Amitraj, so good for them. Neither of them super frequently on tour level lately, but good for them all the same. Yeah, so Collins is the winner. Rybakina, solid result. Again, very off and on year for her. She's had some illness issues, but went and lost second round Australia to Blinkova, but great results interchange. She's a kind of a not traditional wild card, but someone who can either post up and go deep or lose early. She's a tough one to kind of get a read on, I think, at times, but definitely not one to ignore in this tour. The men's side of Miami was won by Jannik Sinner, who continued his dominance this year, adding this title to previous titles in Australia and Rotterdam. His one loss, as I said, only loss of the year, was to Alcaraz in that Indian Wells semifinal. He never looked really in trouble in Miami. He beats Grigor Dimitrov very emphatically. Early in the second set, I went to walk my dog, and then before I got back home, it was over. I was like, oh, this match went really fast in the end. He looks like number one to me easily in power rankings. It's just a question for me of like clay, how fast he gains points on clay, because I sort of think it's a question of when, not if, he's going to reach number one at this point. I said that on Twitter. I think for me, I kind of agree with what the majority is in my poll. I think by the French Open, I think he'll pass. He only made second round there last time, losing to Altmaier, and Djokovic defending champion there. I have to think that a number of points, Sinner will catch up by June. I think he'll be number one going into Wimbledon, is my guess. No pressure, honestly. And obviously, it's a pressure-packed statement to put on somebody, but he's playing so well. Like, I just don't see him. He's playing with, and he's winning with such margin too. That's the thing. He's like winning comfortably, and it's not close a lot of times. It's Świątek-esque, and Świątek 2022-esque in that way. Yeah, I just see him winning his tournaments, his wins this tournament against Grigor 3-1, demolished Medvedev 1-2 in the semifinals. That was shockingly lopsided. 4-2 over Mahach. Rounds before that, Chris O'Connell in straight sets, Vavasori in straight sets. A third round match, he lost a set to Talin Rijkspoor of the Netherlands, winning 6-1 in the third, but nothing where he ever felt really in danger, as far as I could tell. And Rijkspoor played well, but Sinner, yeah, I think he's far and away the player to beat on tour in 2024.
I agree. It was remarkable that just beat down over Medvedev, and seeing Medvedev constantly looking at his box and just like, what the hell do I do? And again, against Dimitrov, who obviously had a great tournament. And it's just so impressive and interesting to just see how complete he is gradually becoming. I mean, he looks complete now, but there can be even more growth. But just in terms of it's been talked about a lot, but his serve, just how much that has improved in such a short space of time, and how it's gone from being like lagging, but the shot that was kind of lagging behind his game, particularly for such a big hitter and with his game style, to now, anytime he needs it, big serve, you know, right, you know, really precise, right on the line.
Yeah,
it's just really reliable, and he's so confident behind it. And also, I'm so just his movement, honestly, just how much he's evolved as an athlete. Obviously, he's been a good athlete since he arrived on the tour, and I think that's probably partly down to his, you know, he played other sports, the skiing. I think you see how skiing has helped him with the sliding on the court and his ankle flexibility, but just the movement,
like ankles is crazy. And hips that he has from skiing, huge parts of this.
But it's actually in Indian Wells when he played Alcaraz, and for that's like the first time I've ever watched an Alcaraz match, and all the hot shots were coming across the net, like almost, you know, 90% of the crazy gets and the improvisational dinks, and I don't know, it was all coming from Sinner, and he's just yeah, it's just, he's moving so well, serving so well. His return is obviously immense anyway. And then off the ground, he's just found this, just such a nice balance. You know, he's obviously, he has massive weapons. His forehand's huge, but it's just so in the same way that, as I said, Alcaraz needs to find the structure. It feels so structured for Sinner, and he understands when he needs to be patient, when he needs to step in, and it's just 10 out of 10, no notes. Great tournament, and yeah, I think it's going to be, I think Sinner is an all-court player, and he's already shown that in his career. I think he's made the quarters of all four slams already.
Yep.
But I think this will be another challenge for him, maintaining, if clay is probably the surface that, if he doesn't have a best surface, it might be that, maybe.
but it's not bad. I mean, he exactly, made a quarterfinal back in 2020, and he beat Zverev on the way there. I mean, that was like already a good run for him, and I think he's like the same way that I was. And obviously, there was more dispute about this, but I, going into this year, I was saying I didn't worry about him in best of five. I didn't think that was a real hurdle for him.
No.
That's the same way I feel about Clay. I think that he's going to be the best. It's a question, like, do I think he's the favorite for the French Open? I think it's a good question, who's the favorite for the men's French Open right now. I think it's a really wide-open kind of thing in a lot of ways, or a competitive sort of thing. You know, Djokovic, Sinner, Alcaraz. I think you have to put Zverev in that mix with how he's played this year and his generally being good on Clay. Is Nadal going to play? I mean, who knows what his health will be like going into the French Open? He's still not out of it yet. We'll see how that all unfolds. But it's going to be interesting. One other guy I want to talk about who we have not mentioned much, just a nice story for this tournament, the Mr. Congeniality of the tour, without a doubt. Grigor Dimitrov is back into the top 10 for the first time since November 2018, after reaching the final of Miami, which is, I think, his third final in the last four Masters 1000 events. I mean, he's really shrunk together a lot of great results. Feels like it should be higher than number, you know, whatever he is in the lower part of the top 10, honestly. Some of his are good results. He's that one player from that generation of anyone in age between basically Djokovic and Medvedev in that sort of, you know, what, like 9-year span of age.
The lost gen.
Roughly. Lost generation, lost boys, whatever you want to call that group. He's the only one of them really still kicking and making noise. And he's been great. I mean, his run was wonderful in this tournament. He lost badly in the final to Sinner, but before that he'd beaten Zverev in a top three setter. He'd beaten Alcaraz in the quarters. He'd beaten Hurkacz in a third set tiebreak. Destroyed Hanfman. Won a tough match, first match against Alejandro Tabilo in the first round. But yeah, Dimitrov is looking solid. And I sort of say every year going to Australia, like, wouldn't it be nice if Grigor just won this tournament? And I still think, like, if Grigor, let's say, wins Wimbledon this year, everyone would cheer. It'd be a very popular result on tour. Beloved person, unproblematic fave. I'm very annoyed at Dave Grutman, noted Miami nightlife impresario, whatever you want to call him, for putting Dimitrov in a photo with the Kushners, and that was unnecessary to his unblemished image. But otherwise, I think that it's been great for Dimitrov, and I think he makes people happy. I think he just lights up rooms. You saw Serena was there to watch him. Serena obviously very happy to see him as well, and she also was talking to Sinner that same day and complimenting Sinner effusively, so that was lovely to see. But Dimitrov is just sort of, Courtney often says he's the, you know, has the Kennergy of the of the tour, to use the modern Barbie parlance, but just sort of the likable, well-meaning guy that way. So I think nothing but nice things to say about him.
And I think his success at this point in his career is really a reflection of just his work ethic and how he's just continually worked hard. I think we've all seen him around the tour. I don't think his passion for the sport has ever really dimmed for a long period, even when he'd fallen out of the top 10 or top 20 and things weren't going as well, and maybe he wasn't living up to where he thought he might want to be. But I think he's always been so enthusiastic and passionate, and I think that's why he's having the success he is now. And as you said, it's been sustained. This has been happening for a while now, and it seems he's improving more and more. just in terms of his level. And I think that Alcaraz match, I should note, was probably one of the best matches of his life, I think. Just in terms of just how well he played. Alcaraz said after that he felt like a 13-year-old on court. But on the same note, those two tight matches against Zverev and Hurkacz were also really impressive. And, you know, in many parts of his career, you kind of would have expected him to lose those matches. One of them, particularly the Zverev one, a few double faults in key moments.
He lost his last 7 matches in a row to Zverev.
Yeah. And just to see him have the mental toughness and confidence to pull it out is really, it's nice. It's just nice. And he's another player who's quite an awkward player, and particularly on grass. And yeah, I think we'll see him sustain it. I don't think there's any reason why he can't continue to play at a high level.
I legitimately mean, I think he can contend at Wimbledon this year if he continues playing this level. And obviously, it's can be a long time in terms of momentum, 3 months from now for that Grand Slam, but he can do it. There's no one who on his day on grass, I think he can't beat potentially. So, yeah, I hope that he can sustain that. You disagree?
No, I agree. I also forgot to mention Serena, and it was just funny and kind of weird to just see her in the old stateswoman role now, just coming up to players after their matches and congrats Jannik, your forehand's amazing, I wish I had a forehand like that. I don't know, it just felt weird to see her in that role for so long.
I think it felt really nice,
but just like after seeing her as a competitor or never seeing her to just, I don't know. Yeah.
I was really happy to see that, actually. And Serena, I think, would like to kind of hang around tennis a bit more. Yeah. I remember very clearly when she was pregnant, she came to the, it's 2017 it would have been, so she came to the French Open that year. And she was, probably like 5-6 months pregnant at that point. And I sort of saw her in the hallways or in some player area. She was hanging out. We were chatting very briefly. She's not happened much with Serena in my life. There's not very many times for idle chat with Serena. Remember saying, sort of half joking to her, something like, "Oh, you just couldn't stay away, could you?" or something from tennis, and she sort of looked like, "No, I really couldn't." Like, this is my this is her world. She is a lifer in tennis, and she is, with her, she is sort of a lifer in the sport, and I think she will continue to enjoy it and can say things to Sinner about his racket head speed and whatever else, and feel really into it. I still remember there's a couple little things with Serena, but I remember that one time at Wimbledon. When she made some, this is late in her career, when she made some joke about how she only comes to the net to shake hands or something, which is the oldest, corniest tennis coach line. And she's, just kind of, she is that way. And I can't imagine her being a traveling coach on tour or anything like that. Or even, I'd be surprised if she was even a Fed Cup captain, Billie Jean King Cup captain or something like that. But doing something just along the lines of being, showing up in royal boxes, once a year at Wimbledon, that kind of thing would be, I think, nice for her to do. I don't know what, in terms of her career in the sport, in terms of, I don't think she'd be a commentator. I mean, she would be a really fun commentator if they ever got her in there, but I'd be surprised if they ever did. I would love for someone to throw a lot of money at Serena and have her do it for at least a tournament. I think it'd be a lot of fun. Yeah, we'll see what she does. But this is her home tournament. She lives, an hour away from Miami Open. So it's nice to see her at least show up for her longtime buddy, Grigor, there. Speaking of Miami, we got a question about the tournament. From Dean R., who says, "I attended Miami at the Hard Rock," which is the venue, the Hard Rock Stadium, "for the first time this year. I attended many years when it was in Crandon Park, the old venue on Key Biscayne. Definitely very different," Dean says. "Would like to hear your thoughts on the venue and the long-term viability of the Miami Open, given some of the player comments." This is my answer now. I think before, because I've been to this tournament 2 or 3 times in its new venue, I kind of compare it to being it's a designer outfit. It's completely the wrong size. It's wearing a designer suit that's beautiful, but it's 7 sizes too big for you. It feels it's nice, but it's weirdly fitting. And should you be wearing it? Debatable. That's kind of how I feel being in that, because it's in this NFL stadium. It's world-class venue. A lot of parts of the building are honestly nicer than any tennis tournament, or as nice as any tennis tournament you see, and nicer than most, certainly, in terms of how modern the venue is, the sort of technology built into the venue, NFL and the sort of professionalism of that and the sophistication of that is on a level that most pop-up tennis tournaments do not touch, bluntly. Like, it has certain parts of it that are within the building, really, really nice. Some of the suites, some of the catering amenities, some of the food amenities that are sort of the more permanent parts of that stadium are great. But then, like, other parts of it are just like, what is happening here? There's like the sight lines. If you ever, I highly recommend, if you're at this tournament, honestly, not buying tickets to the main stadium in the part that is the part that's the part of the permanent seating bowl for the football, the non-temporary part side of that stadium, which is by far the biggest side, unfortunately. That is something the sight lines are at all right for tennis. And I actually think that for the outer grounds too. This was a problem actually, weirdly, at Crandon Park as well. Just like the dimensions of some of the courts are, they're kind of too far back from the court. They're not very just like well-designed outer courts. It's hard to explain without being there, but just not always a nice place to watch outer court tennis. And you have really good vistas compared to some other tournaments like, you know, Cincinnati or Indian Wells or whatever it may be, Washington, that have better hard court sight lines. But the atmosphere on the outer courts can be really nice. Can feel like Key Biscayne, honestly, or like any nice sort of warm tournament, especially, you know, late night matches. You get some Latin American players, can have really good atmospheres there. But as we're going to talk about Premier Tour later, and this possible like reshuffling of the deck of which tournaments survive and don't into this in a possible streamlined venue. And I have to say, Miami feels vulnerable to me in sort of being erased from the tour, just because it, again, it doesn't feel like it's totally not very bespoke, you know, tailor-made, again, saying the clothing size analogy, spot, and parts of it feel weird, and parts of it are, you know, IMG, which has run this tournament for a long time and owned it for a long time, it's always had sort of cost-cutting things they do in sort of parts of the tournament that are kind of dingy, for lack of a better word, in the bowels of the tournament and the press room, that were never glamorous or nice, in both player areas and media areas, certainly. Casper Ruud, I think this question is, we're alluding to this, Casper Ruud had a bit of an on-court rant about this when he came back from taking a bathroom break or a clothing break, whatever, and he was upset that the trailer that he was taken to in his sort of distant court didn't have towels and didn't have cold water for him, and it's only a plastic chair. Parts of this to me read as very diva-ish. I mean, who cares what your chair is made out of, Casper? This is a very first world problem, and there were certainly towels and water available for you on court at all times. But it is kind of emblematic of some cost-cutting stuff that certainly happens, and it's not all like, you know, unlimited budget luxury at times. So you can see how much you want to be sympathetic to those sorts of complaints or not from players. But yeah, it's no longer, it's in a good part of the city, actually, I think, for fans. It's right between the two big cities of, it's on the cusp of Miami and Fort Lauderdale, both which are big cities in the Miami metro area. So it's much more accessible for transport for a bigger population of people than it was previously on Key Biscayne. But the ambiance of the main stadium on Key Biscayne was amazing. And that has not been recaptured at the new Dolphins venue. But I'm curious for you tonight. I don't think you've ever been to this tournament on either location. No. I'm curious what you make of Miami from afar and where you sort of think it fits into the landscape. I will say, adding to this, it's been a very long time. I don't think that Nadal nor Djokovic ever has played at the tournament since it moved from Key Biscayne, which is way back in 2019. And they both skipped it since then. So it kind of feels like it's lost a little bit of cachet, just even from that, from the attendance records of some of the top players.
Yeah. I can't comment. As you said, I've never been to Miami, period. So I can't really comment on some of the, you know, on the ground experiences. Well, actually, first of all, I will say that I was very amused by Casper Ruud complaining to the umpire. That's not the umpire's job in the middle of a match. That's like you're complaining.
Let's complain to the for the tournament director.
Yeah. I think we talked about this in previous episodes. I am not a fan of that stadium. I think. A Masters 1000 event should have a better, you know, showcase court than that, than a temporary stadium in a stadium. I think it looks horrible, and I can certainly imagine that the part that is a permanent just has nothing to, you know, it's not built for tennis and it's not a good experience.
You're just so far away from the court. I think it's hard to explain, but like basically, like you can be in like maybe the, let's say, like 20th row of lower bowl. It's not that far back, but you are so far back distance wise. It's just not anywhere near steep enough as it should be for a tennis experience. Yeah. I'm not actually sure it's good for NFL either. I've never watched an NFL game in the lower bowl of that stadium, but I've been to the upper deck actually years and years ago for the Orange Bowl. But yeah, it's an odd odd place to watch tennis. It just doesn't, again, doesn't fit right. It's not the right fit.
Yeah, it's funny because like growing up watching tennis, I always considered Miami the bigger of Indian Wells of the two.
It used to be the fifth slam. It used to be the consensus fifth slam, Miami. Yeah,
And obviously that was also helped by the fact that the two best American players in the world were boycotting the other event. And clearly over the years, that's completely flipped. And I think Miami has totally lost ground on Indian Wells. Even if I think we're both quite skeptical about the whole tennis paradise moniker for Indian Wells. And, you know, there's not always paradise. It's not ideal in terms of the slower conditions or, I mean, this year with the random rain. But, yeah, I think it's really lost ground on Indian Wells. And the more I think about it, the more I could really do. I think tennis doesn't need it anymore, Miami.
It's interesting because I hear that, but I also think that, like, it makes sense on a conceptual level because Florida is kind of the mecca of tennis in the world.
For sure,
all the academies that are there, it's a historically like important place. But you're right, looking at it without knowing any of that sort of like kind of sentimental reason for advocating for Florida, honestly, on that sort of cultural level, just critically looking at these 9-10 Masters events. We'll get to Premier Tour more directly end of the show, but Miami is if you know, looking at on the sort of rankings or chopping block, Miami is not, I don't sense a strong case for Miami. I know that they worked hard to get a solution to keep the tournament in the Miami area after increased problems with the Key Biscayne venue and the local government and Crandon Park and not letting them renovate the way they would, some sort of public parkland. By the way, Crandon Park, I think, has a lot of really overrated parts of it. I don't think it matters that there's beach like 500 meters away. Like, who cares? Like, it's like, who cares what's like nowhere? It's just the traffic was bad. The site was not nice outside of the main stadium, which I think was small and really well designed. I think that the that tournament was, I think, not great in a lot of ways. And I think it's not all down to that. But I do think that some of the lack of energy that the new stadium has, which is just, again, just being this weird fit, I think exposes some of the overall weaknesses of this tournament. And honestly, and even kind of a lack of, there's not a ton of great Latin American players right now. You know, there's not Del Potro, there's not Rios or Guga Carton or whoever were these other sort of Latin players who were lighting up, Schwartzman even, hell, who were lighting up the stadiums in Crandon Park and making for electric atmospheres. They're not really doing that meaningfully. I guess Nicolas Jarry had a decent tournament in Miami, but not the kind of consistent level that made this sort of the Latin American slam and buzzy in 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. So anyway, I think it's shaky. I would sort of recommend it to go to the outer tournaments. If you like tennis, outer court passes there. I haven't heard it yet, but I would recommend listening to the Body Serve boys, who I know were there this week. And they talk on their episode that came out this Monday about their experiences in Miami on the ground. So I'm curious what their thoughts were. I think they had some snaggles there as well. Snags, rather, there as well. Yeah, the Casper Ruud thing was funny. Just seeing him, kind of not normally complaining, but it's sort of very direct complaint. One more question we got before we head to other, well, general questions now. We mentioned her briefly in this tournament, but question from M. Ziegelheim. He says, my only question is about Sabalenka. She was a dominant Australian Open champion, more dominant than Sinner, even. But while Sinner continues to win, Sabalenka barely wins a match now, and she made at least the semis in all the last six majors. Sabalenka, which you mentioned, one of the big storylines from this tournament early was reports of the death of her boyfriend, Konstantin Koltsov, who she clarified or came out later was her recently ex-boyfriend. They'd split up shortly before this, and he was found dead. It was reported to be a suicide by local authorities from his hotel balcony. So obviously wishing him, his family and everyone else involved in that, peace and condolences. And Sabalenka made a decision to keep playing this tournament, which was uncertain. And she played a couple rounds, won the first match against Badosa, lost her second match in the third round. But apart from that, I guess results wise have not been certainly Sinner-esque from her. And so counting whatever you want to in the personal life side, and who knows what was going on even before this event happened in her personal life, What do you make about Sabalenka's post Australian Open Tamani and where it sets her up for the clay?
It's been a weird one, I think. Even just
when
she came back and lost to Rakic 6-0 in the third set back in the Middle East, that was not great, really. Particularly the scoreline in the end. And then here, again, I agree, it's hard to say anything about Miami after everything that happened. But Indian Wells wasn't great either. And yeah, she obviously set such a great tone of playing consistent tennis last year. But so on one hand, it's not ideal. And I think she goes into a clay season with a lot of question marks around her. But it's still only a few tournaments, so it could just be a small blip. And she, you know, on the clay, particularly on the faster clay tournaments, Stuttgart, Madrid, she might find her feet again and play quality tennis. I think it's a case of wait and see. But she's shown that she can play at a consistently high level. And I mean, once you do that for one season, the question is, how long can you maintain that? So, yeah, we'll see. I think that's where I'm at. I'm uncertain where she's at.
Yeah, I'm uncertain too. But I think that her, as the question alluded to, she has this streak of six straight slam semis. You know, so she's been able to step up at the big tournaments and deliver there. And I have no reason to think that she can't do that again.
For sure, yeah.
You know, at these next Grand Slams the rest of the season, you know, that she can step up these big levels. Her game when she's on has been on. And yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, I'm certainly not selling Sabalenka stock, let's say, at this point. I would hold and just sort of ride it out. I think that she's no cause for long-term panic in her game. I think it's kind of a blip, I would say, for her. Other question, we got a couple questions about wild cards regarding some of the women's players who are making comebacks mostly. Marissa asked, maybe talk about all these returning WTA players continually using up the wild cards at big events without grinding smaller ones to get their ranking up. Though I understand Osaka is going to play the 250 in Rouen, so maybe she's realized she might have to do this, and she's referring to Naomi Osaka entering the, as she said, 250 event Rouen, which is the same week as Stuttgart later this month, which I think is a positive sign. I also got a question similarly from Jess, who says, the unfair wildcard system that everyone says increases viewership, which she wants to know about. Wozniacki did not play at the Asian swing after the US Open. All the ex-players coming back to be part-time tennis players. Wouldn't that do harm to young upcoming girls? My thought is, you know, we can also get into Halep getting a wild card into this tournament as well. We'll get into Halep maybe after this general wild card talk. And, you know, they mentioned Wozniacki and Osaka in these questions. I think Venus Williams also got wild cards into both these tournaments as well. Also, not really a full-time player, it seems like, these days, and less competitive, bluntly, than Wozniacki and Osaka, both of whom won matches, I think, at both tournaments. So it's tough for me to begrudge wild cards to people who are winning matches and who are, you know, former number ones. Like, that seems fine to me. I think that's actually really hard to argue with. If you win a match, you kind of automatically justify your wild card. And then if you're a draw, you kind of automatically justify it as well. That goes for Venus Williams for life, honestly. Like, she will always continue to put butts in seats. People will find her compelling and want to see her, want to see this person they've been watching since the 90s. And I give her a lot of rope on that front, even if, you know, I think it's fair to wonder what her end goals are with tennis at this point or continuing to play on tour. But if I'm tournaments and she asks for a wild card, I'm certainly giving her one at this point and for foreseeable future for me anyway. But yeah, I think for Osaka, we talked about this in a previous episode regarding Raducanu. Osaka, yeah, has played pretty much only really top-level events so far on tour. And so I'm glad that she is zagging away from Stuttgart. And part of it might be a protected ranking consideration or something. I'm not totally sure. But I know, because she'd get a wild card. I'm sure she would get a wild card into Stuttgart if she asked for one. But her deciding to take the wild card instead into Rouen and maybe get a few more matches, especially clay. Clay is, you know, something she still doesn't feel totally comfortable on, increasing her odds of getting weaker opposition for a couple of rounds. I mean, she could still play some top 50 player first round or someone who's comfortable. Who knows what the, I mean, she could play Caroline Garcia again, first round, probably that tournament. I wouldn't be surprised. I think, you know, Osaka, I like that move from her. Osaka's year has been, again, I plug the book, get the book, please. Nice to see some nice reviews for it. By the way, if you've read the book and want to leave a review on Amazon or Goodreads, I appreciate that. As I ramble on, I think Osaka's year, I think the word is for it, I think it's been very whelming. Not over or underwhelming, just whelming. I think it hasn't been great, and I think it hasn't been better than expectations hugely, and it certainly hasn't been worse than expectations hugely. It's just been kind of like very par for me. And this way that she's kind of on track to be like, she's playing like kind of like top 30, top 40 level tennis right now. Right. Which is like, which is good. It's not bad at all, but it's not amazing show stopping either. And so how comfortable she is with that long term, she doesn't, I think she is hoping to obviously pick up the pace and do even better. But certainly, yeah, it's an interesting sort of altitude right now, I think, her tennis. So curious what you think of Osaka, and then this more general question about wild cards as well. And Wozniacki.
Yeah, well, I think that there are two, I guess there are two discussions. On the wild cards, I agree with you. I don't really begrudge these players getting them. They're top players. They're people, players people want to see and speak about. They're, frankly, they're players that my editor, as a journalist, my editors are interested in and want me to write about, which is great. And yeah, I think that they're all clearly trying to get, obviously Venus is in a different part of her career and spot, but the others have been competitive and they're clearly trying to get back to the top. Aside from that argument, I do think there's a separate question over whether playing only top level tournaments is advisable if you want to get back to the top. I thought that with Wozniacki, to be honest, I think we talked about this before. Definitely thought, you know, if again, she has kids now, she has family and she has other, you know, other priorities. But if she wants to get back to the top level, then to me it feels like her, you know, her, given her game style and the way she plays tennis and how physical it is and how much she needs to be on point, you know, every point she needs to be just so focused and consistent that she should probably really be playing, you know, more regularly. And like we saw in, you know, she lost to Kalinina and it looked, she was still, I think, still seems a bit rusty just in terms of the big points. She served for the match and lost that, but then physically she couldn't, you know, yes. How often do you see Wozniacki hurting physically? It's very rare. Obviously it's happened at times, particularly when she was younger, but it's still rare to see her kind of just, you know, gassed in a match. So I feel it would be advisable for her to play more tournaments and more lower level tournaments. And she's actually playing Billie Jean King Cup, which is cool with Towson, so that's, she finally has another top 800.
Sorry, player. I was saying, actually, I didn't say Towson, I said Charleston. She's playing Charleston.
Okay.
Yes.
And she's playing with
Towson. But also with Towson, yes.
Yeah. It's nice that she finally has a top 800 fellow Danish player, you know.
Justice for Malu.
my Grage as well.
Yes.
And what was it? And yeah, and with Osaka, I'm pleasantly surprised by how regularly she's playing and how, you know, just how much she's clearly putting into coming back. Obviously, we know her as someone who played sparingly and, you know, scheduled like she was in her Serena era too. It's been good to see her just playing regularly and now, as you said, I think Ruin is a good step for her playing a clay 250.
I was gonna say we had a match in Indian Wells between Wozniacki and Kerber, which was kind of fun.
Yeah.
In the fourth round, I think there. And I will say the thing about Osaka is the one of these players who I think is meaningfully like a potential future slam winner. I think she's the one who still has the ceiling, I think, to get back to the top. I'm not sure I feel that way about Wozniacki or Kerber, but Osaka can.
Of course, I mean, considering her age, I think that's, yeah, of course. But yeah, I finished on Osaka. Yeah, I agree with you that in terms of her actual level, it's been more like par. Some really good stuff, I really liked her performance against Svitolina, actually. That was a really good match from her. Mm-hmm. Like, she blew Svitolina away in the first set, but then the second set was really tight. So Svitolina getting every single ball back, but she found her way through. But it's still like, the question with her is now playing at that level consistently throughout a tournament, not just one match, and taking her chances. Because she had chances against Garcia, who played well, but then she didn't take them and she lost in two sets. So in conclusion, I'm fine with the wild cards. And I don't think it necessarily takes away from younger players anyway, because I mean, yeah, I.
There are always spots in qualies.
Yeah, as they're not entitled. Also, they're not entitled to wild cards.
Yeah,
and I'd also say that, you know, Osaka went away and had a baby. Kerber went away and had a baby. Wozniacki retired when she was still a, you know, a top-ish player. Players benefited from their absences. So, you know, that there was one more player in every draw that they weren't in. So, yeah, I don't have an issue with this at all.
Mm-hmm. I agree. One last wild card thought on Simona Halep, who got a wild card into the Miami Open. This was criticized by the aforementioned Caleb Wozniacki, who also was critical of Maria Sharapova getting wild cards. This is something that we talked about Halep's decision quite a bit on the last episode. But this is before she got in the wild card into Miami. That came out after we published our episode. Halep played pretty well, but lost her first match to Badosa in Miami. And Caitlin Wozniacki, as she said about Sharapova, said, "I don't think there should be." And she was almost apologetic about how she said it. She was sort of saying, like, "Sorry, but no, I don't think that this should be, I have nothing against Simona, but I don't think this should be a thing when you come back from a doping suspension that you should get handouts or wildcards. I think you should start from the bottom and build yourself up." And unsurprisingly, Halep took objection to this. She said, "I've been totally cleared and I'm innocent, essentially, and the panel proved this." And again, we don't have all the details on the CAS ruling yet. I think this is something that remains, so as we said last time, questions to be sort of answered about why their finding was so different, why they found so far in favor of Halep when the other preliminary decision was really bad for her. So I don't think we have all the satisfactory answers there yet, but I thought it was an interesting moment. I think it's a kind of halfway ground. Now there's talk about WTA also making rules to kind of protect rankings for doping comebacks potentially in some way, or with Halep, I think it's specific that if the CAS ruling is the final ruling, she would have still had some ranking left in theory, because they post-dated, or they, in the appeal win, they shortened her suspension, not just to like immediately come back, but saying you should have been able to come back in July 2023, which would have been like, you know, basically less than a year of suspension total. And she would have still had that Canada title on her ranking, the 1,000 points she would have won for that, or 900 points, whatever. And she would have still been able to get direct into some tournaments with just that one result on her ranking. So it's tricky, but I certainly understand Wozniacki's side. And I wish that Halep had gotten asked the question. I wasn't in Miami, but I wish Halep had gotten asked the question, like, you said this about Sharapova back in 2016. How do you, or 2017, whatever it was, how do you respond to this now? And also, I wish there were more questions about it, period. I didn't get the sense that many players were getting asked about this at all. And I just think the kind of tennis press corps, I'm responsible for this in part from not being on tour right now, but it's kind of anemic. And I feel like some of the basic questions about Halep and that news were not getting asked to players that I saw or heard in Indian Wells or Miami. So I think it was Wozniacki was kind of the only one I saw, unless I'm wrong, got asked about it whatsoever. Maybe Badosa did as the opponent in the first round, but not the sort of critical mass certainly that there was when everyone's getting asked about Sharapova. I remember like Andy Murray being like, "My God, I've been asked about Sharapova so many times," and all the sort of wildcard drama over Sharapova for months. I don't get the sense there's any kind of that, for better or for worse, there's nowhere near that drumbeat around Halep.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm actually quite, I don't know what you think, but I'm actually quite torn on this question of whether a player should receive wildcards. Certainly not if they're, you know, full for 2 to 4 mm-hmm. years ban or whatever. But I do actually think that in other sports, for example, in athletics, you have a ban, and then you probably need like a couple of races. You know, if you're a 100-meter sprinter, you race a couple of times, dip under 10 seconds a few times, and then you're back with the big guys. Whereas or big girls, and whereas with in tennis, obviously starting it does it, in a way. That's an additional punishment, because there are very few players who go from 9999 to, you know, back into the top 50 without any help at all.
We're seeing Kamil Majerczak do this on the men's side. He's coming back from a doping suspension for something that was not, you know, some sort of tainted something, and he had this case of, you know, testing positive several times in short order because of something he had taken. Yeah. But he went back. He's been playing futures. He just won, I think, the Rwanda Challenger or something, and he's sort of building back up. Halep could do that as well.
Yeah. But has he gotten zero wild cards?
Close, like, to zero. Not many. No, nothing tour level, certainly.
No, yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, what's the limit? He has. I see. Yeah, you're right. He's been playing challengers, but he did get a wild card into the Kigali challenger. Kigali challenger. He got one 25k. Like, I mean, those are minimal. Those are like minor, right? But still, yeah. If you're going,
it's still something.
Yeah, it's still something. Like, if you're starting from nothing, then that, without any wild cards, that means you're going and playing like a 15k pre-qualifier, right? And then you're playing a series of 15ks and then a series of 25ks and then a series. So yeah, I'm just
and you're right. How and punishment fitting the crime, like Halep's ruling, as they said, was this 9-month offense, and this sort of like the ultimate verdict was, you know, no significant fault, intent, whatever. And so should they be given grace in terms of wild cards from that? I think it's a reasonable debate to be having.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm not even sure where I fall on that, but yeah, I just think in tennis, the way it's structured, it's almost another punishment on itself. So yeah.
I agree. I'm actually going to cut this here and stop this recap here, and then we're going to do another talk about Premier Tour stuff, because we will get into that more in depth, and that's, we're kind of already running a bit long on time. But thank you for listening to this episode, and we'll be back to you shortly with some talk about Premier Tour and Saudis and all that sort of fun stuff about renovating the tour there, because I know we got thoughts on that to go a while. So thanks, folks, and we'll be back to you with that episode real soon.
Bye.